immigration issues, housing issues. We still fight to make sure that we're bettering our neighborhood. You know, we helped build a park along that river. We have a vision for our community, and that's all we're asking for. It's not anything extra. We're just asking for a chance to fight for clean air and clean water.
New Jersey already facing a threat from sea level rise, double the global average. And Amazon, is it true, is proposing an entire new terminal at Newark Airport that you're fighting?
Absolutely. We're fighting what we call a secret hub, right? Amazon didn't talk to the community and talk to our municipality about it. Port Authority, which is an authority shared with New York and New Jersey, had a vote that appeared halfway through the meeting to authorize this proposal from going through. Again, like our community, and this is why.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to come back to this. Maria Lopez Nunez with the Ironbound Community Corporation. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Portland.
And this is Mark Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. While the Department of Defense has issued new policies aiming to weed out extremism in the U.S. military, experts, including retired U.S. Army Major General Paul Eaton, say the policies don't go far enough. For example, it is still possible for those who are members of extremist and racist organizations like the Ku Klux Klan to remain in the military. There's growing concern about the presidential election in 2014 and how extremist elements in the U.S. military could support a coup. You know, from Timothy McVeigh to Terry Nichols, who bombed the Oklahoma Federal Building in 1995 that killed 168 people, two members of the military participating in the Charlottesville, basically, white riot that happened there, to January 6th, where of those charged, 81 had ties with the U.S. Military. And over the last decade, according to the Washington Post, the numbers of extremists in the U.S. military have tripled. Perhaps these realities are a measure of where the United States stands right now, the divisions in this country. That, along with voter suppression and other measures, President Biden, as you heard in the news headlines, and Vice President Harris to give a speech in Georgia today to try to salvage, if at all possible, the voter laws that are stalled now in Congress. There's a lot going on here, and on the threat of, you know, a possible coup in the 2024 election, let us listen to a clip about what the Michigan Republican Party tried to pull off. Let's go to that clip right now.
Another big development out of the congressional investigation into January 6th. New documents show a group from Michigan attempted to overturn the 2020 election by sending false documents to the state, the courts, and the National Archives. Our Grant Herms joins us now. And Grant, we have not seen these papers before.
No, this is the first time that we've seen these. Now, the January 6th committee has said it would be ramping up its investigation into what happened at the state levels, especially here in Michigan. And this is the first piece of evidence that we've seen come out of this, and we expect that it won't be the last.
Startling new revelations about the lengths some Michigan Republicans went to overturn the 2020 election. New documents obtained by Politico showing 16 Republicans forged and signed papers sent to the National Archives, attempting to certify the election for former President Donald Trump. Among those signees was Kathy Burden, the Republican National Committee member from Michigan, Shelby County Clerk Stanley Grott, the Michigan GOP Grassroots Chair Marion Sheridan, and current State Party co-chair Michon Bannock, who was elected to her post after sending the fraudulent documents. Maddox's husband, Oakland County State Representative Matt Maddox, was among a group of 14 self-appointed electors who attempted to enter the Capitol during the certification process in 2020. The couple also helped charter buses to the Washington, D.C. Stop the Steal rally that would lead to the January 6th insurrection. These new documents also come on the heels of a new election audit from Macomb County, showing yet again the election in the county Trump won was safe and secure.
Was there something in there that might have changed the score? The answer is no. Nothing happened in those servers. Nothing happened in the communications. There is no malicious software. So it was a pretty, I'm comfortable on our end where we're at in Macomb County that our servers were never compromised.
Now, some of those making claims that the 2020 election was stolen are from right here in the Macomb County Republican Party, of which the county clerk is a member. The party here has endorsed several candidates who are election deniers. When I reached out to ask if they'd be rescinding those endorsements because of this audit, I did not get a comment back. Back to you.
Yeah, well, Grant, what is the Republican Party saying about these documents tonight?
So far, nothing. I did reach out today to party officials to see if these signees could face any consequences and didn't get a comment back. Late this afternoon, the Attorney General's office told me that these signees and these documents themselves were part of an ongoing probe, but they couldn't tell me more. So this is something that we'll be following.
Okay, there you go. And I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, who is the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books. His most recently published book is The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. He's also the author of The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Dr. Horn, welcome back. It's been way too long, and we wish you good health, and we're going to need as much strength as we can as we go into 2022. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, and Dr. Horn, there are two major areas that I'd really like to discuss with you in some depth today. On the national front and on the international front, both very, very fraught. On the national front, let's start with the fallout. We recently had the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. President Biden made a speech on the anniversary of that insurrection. But I'd like you to talk a bit about what has happened since, the implications, your thoughts on all of this, what Congress is doing, what should the U.S. Attorney General be doing? And, it's all a very, very scary time for a lot of people, but some way, somehow, we need to be figuring our way out of this or a way to deal with this. So let's start with January 6th and the fallout.
Well, you are correct. We are at a very dangerous and perilous moment right now. Some of your listeners might be familiar with the recent op-ed that appeared in the Toronto Globe and Mail, Canada's version of the New York Times, where a member of the Canadian elite suggested that there might be or could be a coup in the United States in November 2024, and that Canada should prepare itself for a flood of U.S. refugees. On the coup front, just a few days ago in the Washington Post, three leading U.S. generals published a piece where they too suggested that a coup in the United States was possible in November 2024. And I think that you referenced the attempt by the Pentagon to root out extremists. But the question is it too little too late? For example, we know that failed coups and what happened on January 6, 2021 had all the earmarks of a coup. It was an attempt to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. I think we should also take seriously the fact that a gallows was constructed on the grounds of the Capitol, that many of these protesters, so-called, were armed. Many of them had bear spray, pepper spray, handcuffs. And it's apparent that we should take very seriously their chant, "Hang Mike Pence," because I think that they also had mayhem in mind as well. This is taking place against the backdrop of voter suppression, which, as you noted, Mr. Biden will be addressing today. But Mitch McConnell has already indicated that if there is a carve-out created to evade the filibuster in order to preserve voting rights, that he will engage in a scorched-earth policy in the U.S. Senate. And in light of the fact that the Republicans are well expected to reclaim the House and the Senate in November of this year, I think that many in the Democratic Party will be taking his claim seriously, particularly since polls suggest that a hefty majority of Republicans feel that the November 2020 election was stolen. A hefty majority of Republicans also means a hefty majority of Euro-Americans as well. And within that majority, a substantial percentage feels that violence is useful, perhaps even necessary, in terms of effectuating their goals. So this is something that apparently has been able to creep up upon many on the left. They seem to be taken aback by this turn of events, which only explains to me that perhaps they haven't taken the history of this country seriously. They haven't taken the history of settler colonialism seriously. They haven't taken the history of white supremacy seriously. And so in some ways, where we are now is like the patient who comes to the hospital after smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day for 30 years and then expects a miracle cure. It's going to be very difficult to have a miracle cure at this point. And I don't want to sound overly pessimistic, but just realistic. Because as you suggested, you not only have these extremists in the military, you also have them in police departments. There have been exposés about Facebook groups and various local police departments that are replete with vile racist epithets. We know that in Los Angeles County, for example, in the sheriff's department, you have gangs who are infected and polluted with white supremacy. And so this is the state of play as we speak, and it's not a very pretty picture, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah, and to underscore your point, I mean, just last year, you had an army private, this is reported in the Guardian newspaper, who confessed to sharing sensitive information about his unit with members of a neo-Nazi group in order to facilitate an attack. And you also had a Marine Lance Corporal who participated in the 2017 Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. So, you know, you see that, and the tripling of this kind of activity, as you said, it is systemic. And Dr. Horn, in the middle of all of this, you have the defense chief, a black man, Lloyd Austin, who had ordered a period of time, I think a couple of months, stand down to come up with these rules to allegedly get rid of extremism in the military. But as you say, this has had a long history, not only in the military, but in prisons, among prison guards, among law enforcement units. But still in the military, you could be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. You could be a member of the Three Percenters or the Proud Boys or any of these organizations and still remain in the military. So one has to question, how seriously is this effort? And these organizations are continuing to heavily recruit in U.S. military and law enforcement. Dr. Horn.
Well, it is as serious as you portray it. And even the reportage, for example, in the New York Times, is not necessarily reassuring. For example, just a few days ago, the New York Times reported on this group that had a critical role on January 6, 2021. They're called the First Amendment Praetorians. They should be grouped with the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers, and all the rest. But to the best of my recollection, that was the first time they had been mentioned in such a prominent place in the paper of record, which makes me wonder, well, why did it take so long to bring their misdeeds to the fore? And then with regard to January 6th, like many, I'm waiting eagerly for the report by the committee headed by Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi and co-chaired by Liz Cheney of Wyoming, a dissident Republican. But we suspect that if they do not turn in their report by the first Tuesday in November, once the Republicans seize the House, as they're expected to do, there will be no more investigations of January 6th. In fact, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas has already made it clear that a top item on their agenda will be impeachment hearings with regard to President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. With regard to January 6th once more, there are so many questions that need to be answered. For example, Congressman Jim Clyburn of the Congressional Black Caucus made it clear last year that he found it very odd and curious that the insurrectionists, when they invaded the Capitol, they did not go to his office where his name is on the door. Somehow they went to his hideaway, where fortunately he was not cited. But there are many indications that this might have been both an outside job and an inside job, with the finger of accusation pointed at a number of congresspersons who were refusing to cooperate with the committee. Speaking of Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, others would include Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama, Congressman Paul Gorsuch of Arizona, who, by the way, you might recall, circulated a damning graphic of him murdering Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez of Queens. And then with regard to the other questions that somehow have not been answered, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, once again of the Black Caucus, recalled that in early 2021, the panic buttons in her office somehow were stripped out. And there's still been no answer as to how and why that occurred. And we also know that questions are hanging fire concerning the inordinate delays in terms of dispatching the National Guard to the Capitol. Governor Larry Hogan of neighboring Maryland wanted to dispatch the National Guard from his state, but they ran into a roadblock. I trust and I hope that Congressman Thompson will be looking at the role of the brother of disgraced Trump National Security Advisor, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. That brother was in the chain of command at the Pentagon at the time that these requests were being made. So there are so many questions that need to be answered, and I'm not even sure if we'll know the answers by November 2022.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it has come out that Vice President Harris was actually in the building. Remember where a bomb was left outside the office of the Democratic Party? And that has only recently come out that she either was in the building or had been earlier, you know, in that building. And it remains to be seen what U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland is going to do about all of this. But Dr. Horn, just quickly before we go on to the international front, because a few things I'd like to discuss with you there. You know, a lot of Black folks, a lot of brown people, Black and brown people, are quite upset right now with the Biden administration, who the claim is the administration has not done much to push forward voting rights. And there's a lot of worry about what's going to happen with these midterms, because the assumption is that the GOP will take over both the House, you know, as well as the Senate. But a lot of that also depends on the turnout of the Democrats base. And the worry is people being so upset with the Biden administration that they won't turn out to vote. And that leads us all in the hands of the GOP, which is dominated by Donald Trump. and the kinds of policies that he stands for in his hands and leading up to 2024. Who knows what will happen then? Just a quick thought on that, Dr. Horn, before we go to the international front.
Well, I think the anger and the fury is justifiable. That's one of the reasons why many voting rights groups are boycotting Mr. Biden's and Vice President Harris's appearance in Atlanta at Ebenezer Baptist Church, the former church of Martin Luther King Jr. I understand that Stacey Abrams, the voting rights leader and a candidate for governor of Georgia, will somehow not be there as well. But I think as well that we need to realize that the stakes are very high right now with regard to November 2022 and certainly November 2024. We need all hands on deck, but certainly once again for our friends on the left, we really need a deeper and more realistic analysis of how we got to this point of danger when we've been told for decades that this country is sort of an example, a sterling example of democracy, which obviously is not true. And one heartening note, if I may conclude, is that even in the citadels of the status quo, speaking of Ivy League law schools, you have professors now who are disputing this idea of the United States as being democratic, and all they need to do is point, of course, to the antiquated Electoral College, not to mention the structure of the U.S. Senate, which means that a vote for the U.S. Senate in Wyoming is worth many times, many times, many times more than a vote for the U.S. Senate in California.
Dr. Horn, we hope that you will be part of our panel this Friday when our weekly roundtable returns for the first roundtable of 2022, where we'll continue this discussion. But turning now to the international front, the tensions growing between the U.S. and Russia, the talks that happened recently between the United States and Russia, where, by the way, the EU was complaining, hey, we're being left out of these talks, and it very much impacts us, Europe, what happens with NATO. But it seemed as though not a whole hell of a lot came out of those talks. There's a lot of talk about Russia possibly invading the Ukraine. But Dr. Horn, a little bit of the history of why perhaps Russia has a bit of a case for being upset about what NATO is doing close to their borders. Do they have a case, Dr. Horn?
Well, certainly they do. Recall what happened during the October crisis of 1962, where the United States was about to blow up the world because the Soviet Union had placed defensive missiles in Cuba. The United States felt that that was a threat to their security, even though they were defensive missiles, and there was a stare down. Now, imagine what would happen if a left-leaning government came to power in Mexico City, and the government of Mexico City decided to place Russian missiles or Chinese missiles in Mexico that the United States would see as a threat to its international peace and security. The United States rather routinely sails into the Black Sea along Russia's borders. It sails into the South China Sea along Chinese borders. But imagine what would happen if Chinese or Russian vessels would sail into the Florida Straits just south of Miami. I think that the United States has not awakened to the fact that the days of being the sole remaining superpower are over, that the 90s are long and thankfully gone. And there is a question that needs to be posed to these Europeans. They're basically being played for chumps. They're basically playing the pips to the United States Gladys Knight, which it seems to me is rather ludicrous for a nation that by some estimates has the largest consumer market on planet Earth with 450 million. And so I think that these strains at the final analysis might lead the French in particular to lead the Western Europeans, speaking of the European Union, away from U.S.-dominated NATO and towards what Mr. Macron calls, quote, strategic autonomy, unquote.
So you have that going on, and I mean, following the talks that took place earlier this week on Monday, you had the Russia, their side basically saying that the Ukraine should never, never, ever become a member of NATO. And then you have the United States, the counterpart to the Russian foreign minister, saying, well, you know, wait a minute, we're leaving the door open for that happening. So all of that remains to be seen. But another backdrop happening here is it seems to be more of a cozying up between Putin and Xi, between Russia and China, seemingly as a challenge to U.S. Hegemony and the assumption of the United States being the world's preeminent military as well as economic power. Dr. Horn, your thoughts on this?
Well, what you're exposing with the comment is the ham-fisted approach to strategy. That is to say, you are correct to suggest that China and Russia are becoming as close as lips and teeth. But at the same time, you have Russia as a major arms supplier to India, which has a bone to pick with China. You have Russia as a major ally and arms supplier to Vietnam, which has a bone to pick with its erstwhile communist ally, speaking of the People's Republic of China. And so instead of using the usual imperialist trick of divide and conquer, that is to say, to try to woo Russia away from China, just like China was wooed away from the Soviet Union in the early 1970s, the United States seems to be bent on driving these two forces together. I don't think it's going to work. It's almost designed to malfunction and certainly will end in tears.
Right. Well, on that note, Dr. Horn, we are going to have to leave it there, but to be continued, a lot happening. There are a lot of tension in the region, Hong Kong, Taiwan, China flexing its its muscle, so to speak, including in the race to outer space. So we'll see how all of this goes. Dr. Horn, thank you so very much. You stay well and safe, and we hope to speak with you later on in the week. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All righty. We are going to take a station break. And when we return, Laura Carlson waiting to speak with us. A lot going on south of the border. Even the New York Times has acknowledged in a headline that leftists are ascendant in Latin America, and there are other elections that are coming up. So we'll find out and dig in a bit deep on what's happening south of the border. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
O por dichos he respetado tanto. Ese hombre que por dichos o por hechos es festejado tanto. Debiera olvidar que casi va solo cuando desnudó.
Alrighty, and that song is Ese Hombre. This is Margaret Prescott. The song, by the way, is by Silvio Rodriguez. If you have missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe to a free podcast. We are also online. You can check out our website at sotrueradio.org, and we're really trying to keep up our community calendar and other news there. Also, if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook, our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio. And we are nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. SoundCloud, by the way, is a free app. You can just go there and look for Sojourner Truth with Prescott. And today I would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Newark, New Jersey. How about Newark, New Jersey? And internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners, all of our SoundCloud listeners south of the border. We are now going to turn our attention to exactly what's going on south of the border, because even as in the United States, there is talk about the U.S. moving towards civil war. You're talking about a country that is so divided, where you have the vast majority of Republicans believing that Joe Biden wasn't really elected as president. Just goes to show you what is happening in this country, despite any evidence whatsoever. You, in the earlier segment, we talked about the rise of extremist organizations, racist organizations within the U.S. military, and the threat that that might pose, even as many people are saying that January 6th was just a test run to a possible coup in the United States in 2024. I mean, this is no joking matter. This is just reality. But south of the border, we see something else happening. And Laura Carlson is going to fill us in on all of that, from Honduras to Chile to Peru, Venezuela even. We'll see what's happening there. But first, let's go to a clip of what happened in Chile, because there is a new president of Chile, the youngest president that country has had, and he's a movement person. He came up in the movement. He's a former student activist, Gabriel Boric, by the way, 35 years old. All you young folks who are listening right now, let us go to a clip from CNN about that election.
Turning our attention to Chile, where Gabriel Boric's supporters are celebrating his presidential election victory. At 35 years of age, the former student activist turned legislator will become the youngest president of Chile since the country's return to democracy in 1990. Far-right presidential candidate José Kast conceded on Sunday evening. Now, Boric will replace the outgoing president, Sebastián Piñera, who is set to leave office in March. The election, one of the most polarized in decades, and comes amid social unrest in Chile over inequality and political discontent. CNN's Rafael Romo joins me now live from Santiago, where he's been covering this election. And in the end, Rafael, it was a pretty clear win for the left.
It was clear and it was quick. And well, less than 2 hours after polls closed, the losing candidate, José Antonio Kast, had already conceded. And shortly thereafter, current President Sebastián Piñera had reached out to Gabriel Boric, not calling him on the phone, that's old-fashioned now, but through a video conference call that was televised nationally. Piñera congratulated Boric and also said he was very proud of the election itself, which had a massive turnout. The challenge now, Michael, is that Boric made a lot of promises that may prove hard to keep, as international analyst Robert Funk told me earlier. Let's take a listen.
He made a lot of promises during the campaign. Is he going to be able to deliver?
He's going to have a very hard time. You know, he's confronting a deadlocked Congress. He's got a constitutional convention. He's got a very fractious coalition. It's not clear what role the Communist Party is going to play in his coalition, whether the Socialist Party will join or not. And he's got a difficult economic situation. We're coming out of the pandemic and the economic effects of that. And he's, as you say, he's made a lot of promises that cost a lot of money. Many of the things coming out of the Constitutional Convention are, you know, social and political rights are likely to, have an effect on the fiscal spending. And so he's going to have a hard time meeting all of that.
More than 8 million people cast their votes Sunday. Boric won with 55% of the vote. But let's not forget that José Antonio Kast obtained 44%, and that there are many unhappy people. Boric will face a divided Congress, and legislators on the right who were supporting Kast during the campaign may make Boric's life very difficult once he takes office in March for a four-year term. Michael.
All righty, so that's Gabriel Boric, as it is pronounced, the new president of Chile. So we'll see how that goes. Let us welcome Laura Carlson, director of the America's program. She works with Just Associates, an international feminist organization. She's based in Mexico City and a regular contributor to America's Updater, Foreign Policy and Focus, Counterpunch, and several Spanish language publications. Laura Carlson is also a television host and commentator on globalization, the drug war, immigration, gender issues for various international news outlets. Laura Carlson, welcome, and all the best to you as we go into 2022. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret. Happy New Year, and Happy New Year to everyone out there who's beginning their year.
Right. Well, a lot of happy people, it seems, in several countries in south of the border, in Latin and Central America, because we see, in a way, almost the opposite happening there to what is happening in the United States. But there's a lot to cover, but we did the clip on Chile, so let's talk about that. And one has to wonder, to a key word having to do with Chile, not only the power of the people that brought in this new president, but lithium, the importance of lithium around the world now, as, countries are talking about the green economy and the need for lithium. But tell us a bit about the lead up to the election in Chile and the wider implications of the election result. Laura Carlson.
Yeah, thanks, Margaret. It's good to be in a position to give good news, especially at the beginning of the year, and especially after the stories, the excellent analysis by Dr. Horn of what's happening in with Ukraine and Russia and tensions around the world. So, yes, we have, at the end of the year, elections in Latin America. We have some major gains by progressive forces, and this is good news not just because the pendulum shifts from right to left again, as it has often in the history of the continent, but because of the direct impact that it could potentially have on so many lives. Well, Gabriel Boric, we mentioned, is a former student leader, member of Congress. His coalition was called Approved Dignity, and he won by 56% of the vote to just 44% for CAST of the far right. Now, one thing that's important and interesting to note here, especially after your introduction regarding the divisions within the United States, is that these elections are showing those same kinds of polarizations. Jose Antonio Kast, the candidate of the far right from the Social Christian Front, defended the dictator Augusto Pinochet. He was in favor of repressing social protest in which scores of young people have had their eyes put out. He is against sexual and reproductive rights of women, and he actually won the first round of the elections, where there were a slew of candidates, with 27.9% of the vote on a law and order platform and calling for more of a crackdown. He would not have supported the constitutional assembly process. But then with the unity of the left in the second round, Boric won handily. But that leaves you with a society, again, that's delicately balanced or imbalanced and a bit unstable between the far right and the left, which in this case would not be called the far left, but it still represents a number of really core progressive principles. Boric is a feminist. He's in favor of the rights of diversities and indigenous peoples. As you mentioned, he comes out of a grassroots movement background, and not just any grassroots movement. This is the student movement that changed the face of Chilean politics. After, for years, being a model of the neoliberal economic movement, I mean the model of the neoliberalism itself, the students came out in the streets to call out the profound inequalities and the privatizations, the impact it was having on their lives and their futures. And now there's a general consensus that the model was flawed, and that he is going to try to construct a government that goes against that neoliberalism. And this is one of the common features of several of the progressive governments that have come to power in Latin America recently.
Yeah, and tell us about, I mean, there's the election, but Chile is also in process now of writing a new constitution that has a lot of wider implications. What can you tell us about that? I mean, we know that Chile, for example, is the world's second largest lithium producer. I think the New York Times is reporting Australia as the first, but it sounds as though people have an opportunity now to really write a new constitution, you know, showing the way forward. And indeed, even the Wall Street Journal is, well, Bloomberg is actually claiming that Chile could be creating a new economic model in Latin America. Laura Carlson.
Yeah, that's right. The Constitutional Assembly is so important in all this. And one of the most important aspects is that Boric supports that process. They're mostly independents and they're mostly young and progressive. The delegates who are elected in an open process to take part in that Constitutional Assembly. It began on November 14th in 2019 with an agreement among political parties after the demonstrations in the streets, and it has to end in September with this proposal and then go through another voting process. And it's a constitutional assembly. That means it's going to the roots of the society and the laws and creating a whole new structure. There are a number of key pillars that they want to come out of that, including rolling back a lot of the privatization and expanding services and a care economy, especially now, although Chile is one of the most vaccinated countries in the world. It has been hard hit by the pandemic, and they're talking about really guaranteeing the rights of different peoples. Now, you've mentioned a number of times the issue of extractivism, and Chile's neoliberalism, the success of it was really built on that extractivism, in particular copper, and now, as you said, lithium. So one of the big challenges of what could be and should be a new economic model is how you deal with that, because extractivism tends to displace indigenous and rural communities, and it tends to deepen inequalities, which is why the country became so unequal in part during this whole period of neoliberalism since the coup. It's going to be a fascinating process. It has to go hand in hand in some senses with the kinds of changes that Boric is going to make, and at the same time there will be a virulent right and international right, because the international right is also very interested in making sure that these progressive processes do not flourish in Chile. There's going to be a very, very significant pressure from the right to sabotage both these processes.
Right. And before we go on to some of the other elections in some of the other countries, talk briefly about the role of Mexico's president. I was reading an article that AMLO, Manuel López Obrador, the Mexican president, that he has invited Boric to Mexico and is talking about a strategic alliance between the countries, and that AMLO is interested in preserving the lithium extraction from private developers to being controlled by the government. But Laura, it does seem though as though there's going to be a delicate balance there about protecting the environment and this extractivism. I imagine Boric will have to play that. The Machupe people in Chile, they certainly have been were very, very present in the protests that led up really to someone like Boric being elected, and they have concerns around the environment. But just tell us a little bit about these alliances that are happening or possible, for example, between Mexico and Chile, and what that could possibly mean.
Well, first of all, in terms of regional integration, the invitation of López Obrador has to do with a new process that's been invigorated by the electoral success of candidates within Latin America, progressive candidates, the Grupo de Puebla. One is called the CELAC. There's a number of regional organizations that are progressive and that have attempted to, in some way, supplant the more right-wing organization American States. And they're important because they support each other in these efforts to change the neoliberal model. And that's what López Obrador is seeking in the meeting with Boric. And they have a close alliance also with, of course, Bolivia's President Luis Arce, who congratulated Boric, saying this is a triumph for the Chilean people, but also for Latin American democracy. Alberto Fernandez in Argentina. These governments have recognized immediately that this has significance for their own efforts and for progressive currents within the continent all over. When you add to this the very high possibility that Luis da Silva will win the elections in Brazil, an economic powerhouse in the region, on October 22nd, the first round is on October 2nd of this year, and the polls are showing him over 20%, 20 points above the incumbent, the right-wing Bolsonaro, and the possibility that Colombia's progressive candidate, Gustavo Petro, will win in the Colombian elections with the first round on May 22nd, you know, you've got a very different geopolitical scenario here in Latin America that opens up more space, and especially an alliance, for making some of those very difficult progressive changes. The second issue, though, is, again, the lithium and the extractivism. While López Obrador just recently made this proposal that the development of lithium findings here in Mexico be under state control so that the benefits will go to the people, and he's pressing that a lot in recent days. This has been also the tack of the Bolivian government and other progressive governments, but it has caused conflicts with indigenous peoples, and it has caused conflicts with environmentalists. So there's real need within that to analyze and to rethink making an economy built on national control of extractivism in a future where extractivism is one of the main causes of climate change and of some of the violent local conflicts and inequalities that we're seeing throughout the world.
Right, and you know, moving forward towards a so-named green economy, and you know, folks interested in electric cars, et cetera, realizing the batteries, you know, are needed for it, and having to consider a lot of indigenous lands in the United States, but also south of the border, that on the continent of Africa with cobalt, et cetera, that will be negatively impacted by all of this. So all of this is going to have to be looked at very, very carefully as the environmental crisis is addressed. But Lauren, amazing that Lula in Brazil, who not that long ago was imprisoned, right, may yet again become president of Brazil. But also talk a little bit also about Venezuela, because the Maduro government, post the death of the late Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian revolution there, the United States has had, and its allies, a concerted effort to really undermine that government, undermine the Bolivarian revolution, all kinds of propaganda flying, so it's hard to know what's really happening on the ground in Venezuela unless you actually go there and see what's going on, exploiting perhaps, you know, divisions and corruption that may happen in the government. But the election that happened there recently, I mean, the opposition was handily defeated. There is one little hope that they had, which is in the region that apparently Hugo Chavez hailed from. Opposition figure did win as governor. But tell us a little bit about the implications of, after so much effort put in by the United States and Western powers, that the Maduro and his government seems to be hanging in there in Venezuela.
Well, Laura more Carlson. Than hanging in there. I think the elections were positive on November 21st. The United and for the participation, the degree of participation And there were over 300 international observers who basically found them to be much, much improved from past elections. In those elections, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela won 20 of the 23 governorships in Caracas. So now the opposition, in a redo, has won the province where Hugo Chavez had his stronghold, Barinas, and they're making a lot out of it, the end of the electoral force of the Chavistas, but they won 20 of the 23 governorships in Caracas. And so what it's showing is that there is still a strong base of support. Now, that doesn't mean that, I'm not saying that party or the government is without criticism, but I think that this move toward elections in which the opposition participated because they'd called for a boycott in previous elections, and the move to create a more even playing field within those elections has been positive. And even the fact that, the opposition was recognized as the winner of this province, that's part of what a democracy is. And what it shows is not necessarily a trend, but what it shows is that people are voting within a functioning democracy, and now with the participation of an opposition that's actually competing in that way. And just very quickly, because I know we're getting close to the end, I wanted to move on to Honduras because it's a small country, but what happened there was really large, and that is that in a 51% to 36% landslide, the country got rid of what they called the narco dictatorship of Juan Orlando Hernández, who was not running himself, but another member of his elite was running, and elected the first woman president ever, with the most votes ever gained by a presidential candidate and the highest turnout. So social movements made a clear decision to participate in the election in a context that could hardly be worse, with 10% open employment, 70% precarious or sub-employment, 9% drop in the economy, 74% of the people living in poverty, homicides and femicides up, and the corruption that we've seen with even the president's brother sentenced for drug trafficking. It's no wonder that an estimated over 1 million Hondurans are now living outside the country. But with this vote, they were able to express the need for a radical change, and it has generated a whole new atmosphere within the country. I've been working there since the coup in 2009, and have many friends there, and they're writing things like, come visit us in Honduras free from dictatorship. There's a lot of hope, there's a lot of energy, a lot of participation of grassroots movements to now take over more of a care and repair agenda, where they're going to be looking to roll back some of the authoritarian and corrupt measures of the previous government, and to begin to direct state funds toward the drastic needs of the people, as well as repairing the democracy itself.
Right, just amazing news out of Honduras, and a lot of good news south of the border. We covered that when that coup against Manuel Zelaya happened in Honduras, the democratically elected president, a coup backed by the United States. So now we see a turnaround happening there. Laura Carlson, we hope that you join us again as part of our regular panelists on our weekly roundtable later on this week on Friday. Thank you so much for breaking all of this down for us. And we'll be continuing these conversations and keeping an eye on the good news coming out of Central and Latin America. Just goes to show you, when the people organize, things happen. Thank you, Laura Carlson. Thank you so much.
That's right. Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. Well, we're out of time. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. And I'd like to thank Jose Benavides, who's been filling in the breach as we are in the search for our new assistant producer here on. We want to thank Gary Baca, our engineer, for today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow, but stay tuned now for Democracy Now. Thank you for listening, and all the best for 2022. And you all, please remember to stay safe as we go out with Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changing. Thank you for listening.
I'm writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. Thank you.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Today on Wings, Sarah Schulman speaks about her nonfiction book titled Conflict is Not Abuse.
So this book begins with something that so many things in our time begin with, a quote from James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Sarah Schulman has won awards and fellowships. She's had a dozen novels published and several plays and screenplays.